Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
Stu does America.
Here I am, doing America. What are you doing for America? Are you subscribing to youtube.com/StuDoesAmerica? This is the best thing you could do for the country. People don't know that, but that's true. Many people are saying it. Hit the bell for notifications while you're there. Also get your Stu Does America merch at StuDoesMerch.com. The code Stu10. Get 10% off your entire order. Inez Stettman is here to fight for the rights of straight males everywhere. You know, it's about time. It's about freaking time. Pope Francis has passed away. We'll look at what comes next for the church. But we're also going to start by doing Tony Evers' slippery veto. This is a story really less about Tony Evers, because honestly, unless you happen to live in Wisconsin, is he of any impact on your life? I mean, people don't even know who the guy is. But I will say, this is a nice little snapshot of your government and how it operates. Maybe just taken to the absolute extremes in Wisconsin. Wisconsin Supreme Court says governor's 400-year edit was within veto authority. Now, if you have not followed this story, it is one of the most, it's one of the craziest things. It's hard to believe it's a real story. If you have not followed this, it's almost impossible to believe that it's actually going on in our country. But this is real. This is really happening. The sentence, dull but clear, was buried in 158 pages into Wisconsin's budget. The sentence was, for the limit for the 2023-2024 school year and the 2024-2025 school year, the sentence read, when it was passed by the Republican-controlled legislature, add $325 to the amount school districts could generate through property taxes for each student. But by the time Governor Tony Evers, a Democrat, and his veto pen were finished, it said something else entirely. Now, this is the sentence. Now, remember, the legislature, they're the ones that make the law. They pass a law, this is particularly in a budget, it's part of a budget. It is handed for what's normally a signature. Now, Governor Evers has line item veto power, so he's going to go through this a little bit. But this is what the Senate says. For the limit for 2023-2024 or 24-25 at $325. So let me show you this is what the edit looked like. Initially, it said for the limit for the 2023-2024 school year and the 2024-2025 school year at $325, so the results under par. Now, what he did, bring that last one up again if you could, because what he wound up doing was editing what's in red on this page. And I want to explain this to the podcast audience as well. For the limit, for, they take out the word the, but leave 2023 dash, then take out 2024 school year and the 20 in the middle of the year, but leave in 24-25 school year, but taking out the dash in between. Now, you might say, wait a minute, what are you even talking about? Let's boil down to what it says. After his edit, it says, you can keep that up there, please, for the limit for 2023-2425, add 325 to the result. So what he did was, instead of it being 2 years, 2023 and 2024, he extended it to 2023 to the year 2425, a 400-year tax increase. That's the kind of thing that sells in Wisconsin, apparently. Can you increase my taxes for the next 400 years, guaranteed? Yes, they can. Democrats can do that. So to boil this down, Republicans passed a law that we're going to give 2 years of this tax increase. The governor crossed out half of years. He vetoed, literally, when it said 24-25, he just turned that into the year 2425, to change a 2-year tax increase into a 400-year tax increase because he wanted more of your money. First of all, you'd think that would get him immediately thrown out of office, but I guess in Wisconsin, this stuff sells. Of course, obviously, what Republicans did would say, okay, we'll just go to the Supreme Court. We'll get this taken care of. Well, this is how the New York Times described it. It was clever. Was it clever, New York Times? Creative, perhaps even a bit subversive, extending the increase 4 centuries longer than lawmakers intended. But was it legal? On Friday, the Wisconsin Supreme Court said, yeah, in a 4-3 ruling in his lawsuit challenging Mr. Evers'
use of his partial veto authority. It's really partial. The court's liberal majority said the governor had acted legally. The three conservative justices on the court dissented. Wisconsin has a long bipartisan history of inventive vetoing. That's what they're calling it, inventive. That has led to intermittent outrage from whichever party does not hold the governorship. Though many states give their governor the right to veto parts of bills, Wisconsin governors have long wielded a distinctly expansive veto authority in which they can cross out words or numbers, sometimes changing the meaning of a bill. That authority has been reined in over the decades, but not eliminated. Now, there have been some creative uses of this power in the past by both parties, by the way. Governor Tommy Thompson, a Republican, deployed the so-called Vanna White veto to nix individual letters in the 1980s. Voters then amended the Wisconsin Constitution to say a governor could not make new words in an appropriation bill simply by erasing letters. Do you really have to say that? Apparently so. Apparently so. Again, that was the 1980s. This is not a recent problem. Still going on. 2005, Governor Jim Doyle shifted more than $400 million to schools, he was a Democrat, by crossing all but 20 words out of a 752-word section of the budget, stitching together an entirely new sentence. That led to another amendment to the state constitution, this time banning Frankenstein vetoes that pieced together two parts of two or more sentences. Are we children? Really, are we children? Scott Walker got into this game as well. That amendment did not explicitly ban crossing out individual numbers, an opening for, some say, a loophole that Governor Scott Walker, a Republican, used to change December 31st, 2018 to December 3018, involving school districts and energy efficiency projects. A thousand-year veto. That episode, which became known in Madison as the thousand-year veto, was also challenged in the Wisconsin Supreme Court. In that case, the court found that the lawsuit had not been brought in a timely manner and allowed the veto to stand. This is absurd. It doesn't matter who does it. It's completely crazy. In a statement on Friday, Mr. Evers said the court's decision is a great news for Wisconsin's kids and our public schools who deserve a sustainable, dependable, and spendable state support and investment. I exercise the same line item veto authority that has been used for decades worth of Wisconsin governors, the governor said. The case put the Supreme Court in the middle of another battle over partisanship and power in the closely divided state. The court, which flipped from conservative to liberal control in 2023, has heard pivotal cases in recent years over election results, redistricting abortion. Now, there's a bunch of ways you can look at. Let me broaden this a little bit here. Not just talking about Wisconsin, but talking about the way you think about law generally. Take it to the Supreme Court, for example. There's this sort of battle that goes on with what you're supposed to do in the Supreme Court. How this is a battle, I don't know. I frankly don't understand it. I've always thought, I've always taken a very strong position on this. But there's the idea of your view of how you should interpret the Constitution, right? And we go through this all the time. For example, there's originalism. This is the right answer, by the way. Originalism. It's basically, hey, what did they actually mean? What were they trying to do? When something comes out and it says, you're having trouble interpreting a couple of years later, I mean, the Second Amendment's an obvious example of this. People read the exact terms and they're like, well, that we don't use that fancy language anymore. What do they mean? Maybe they meant ban all guns. Who knows? And so, originalism says, hey, look at what they wrote at the time. Look at what they were trying to say. When you look back at that, it's quite clear what they meant in the Second Amendment. They, what a militia was at the time, what well-regulated meant at the time. And the idea that quite clearly the founders said, hey, we want to be able to have a well-armed population that has basically the same weapons available to the military at the time. That's basically what it was. They were pretty clear about it. You could say, all right, well, it's sometimes hard, right, to figure out what, people meant that wrote a law, right? It is. I mean, like you go back and look at the Constitution, there is some disagreement on certain things. I don't think all of it's that difficult, but the left tries to make it difficult. Anyway, the difference here with the Wisconsin situation is we know what they meant because they're all still alive. We could just ask them. In fact, they wrote down what they meant pretty clearly and they manipulated it entirely. The other version of the Constitution that people talk about is the living Constitution. You've heard the living Constitution. This is what the left loves to bring up, the living Constitution. This basically means, well, when society changes its values, changes what it, you know, really likes, we just kind of like interpret the Constitution to fit what we feel today. This, by the way, is an insane way to look at the Constitution and should be disregarded completely. But this is kind of the way, you know, people on the left of the court look at the Constitution. It doesn't really matter what they meant at the beginning. What do we want it to mean now? That being said, even with that interpretation, the Wisconsin situation makes no sense if you apply it in Wisconsin. That idea, it's not, there's been no time to change. They just passed it. They're just completely ignoring. They're letting a monarch rewrite the law completely, changing what they want. This is completely crazy. And of course, the last one is textualism. And I guess this is how it would be somewhat be defended. I guess if you take the letter of the law, if you will, and apply it to the veto power of the governor, you can kind of come up with a way that he can do this. Of course, they've tried to overturn this over and over and over again in the courts. They've now overturned several of Evers' own vetoes, but this one they didn't get to. Lawyers, this is how, we want to talk about textualism. This is like reading, you know, you could say if you read something that was in a constitution or in a law, even if it's not worded the exact way that you meant, you got to stick by the text no matter what. It's there, it's the text. You're going to stick by the text, right? Well, this is kind of, you want to talk about a really narrow version of this. This is what they're attempting. Lawyers for Mr. Evers insisted that the veto, even if unusual, was well within his authority under Wisconsin law. Numbers, they argued, were not letters and thus could be deleted individually under the Wisconsin Constitution. Got that? The people, they got what this all went to the Supreme Court when other people tried it, and they said you can't just delete individual letters. And he said, well, they're not letters, they're numbers. So we can do that. Now, I'm curious as to how every spending bill would go in the future if you got a Republican governor, because they could just take out all the numbers and then not spend on anything that he didn't want to. Is that the right way? Now, look, I might like the result of that. However, that is not the right way to run a civilization. If you have a legislator that passes the laws, you can't just delete words, letters, numbers out of that, dashes out of that particular text to completely reverse the meaning of it. And yet that somehow made it through the courts. Now, you might say, well, this got it's going to change really quick. I mean, obviously, they're going to reject this, right? No, in fact, if you remember, this was the election that Elon Musk was so fired up a few weeks ago. A Democratic-backed Susan Crawford won the Wisconsin Supreme Court seat, cementing a liberal majority, which they had since 2023. If you remember talking about the breakdowns here, how Democrats won Wisconsin 2025, well, they got turnout. And you see this pretty clearly in the numbers. Non-presidential elections have taken a more Democratic tilt of late in Wisconsin. Not a huge surprise. This is like the founding place of progressivism. But in Republican, like in presidential years, you're seeing a really big, you know, a Republican lean. But when in the off years at 2025, only 1 year, not even a few months after they elected Donald Trump in Wisconsin, a 7-point Democratic margin in the state. And of course, you know, as Elon Musk was warning at the time, this is going to have major repercussions. Now we've got multiple more years of a liberal majority. And I believe the next person who comes up in the Supreme Court in Wisconsin is another one of the conservatives. And that's not till 2026, I think. So this state of affairs is there. And of course, there's no liberal justification for this type of nonsense either. They're just supporting their guy. There's no justification for this. This is completely crazy. You think it's a joke, but it's not. We have the governor going intentionally against the will of the legislature. This would be a constitutional crisis if it happened nationally. However, in Wisconsin, it's just like the way things go. We all know it's insane. Let the insanity continue. Doesn't matter whether it's a Republican or Democrat, however, it's just wrong. It's obviously wrong, and this is not the way this stuff is supposed to work. Our government is becoming just a series of trolls. Like, if you're on, think about it. It's like if someone tweeted something and you edited the tweet to take out some letters to change the meaning, that would be so morally wrong, it would stand out even on Twitter, which is not necessarily known as the most moral place in America. Yet, you can do this with the law. You can do this with the budget. You can do this with people's money. You're talking about tax dollars being ripped out of the pockets of your voters for the next 4 100 years. And everyone stands back and is like, oh, gosh, well, this is normal. This is the way things go. The courts approve of it. Hopefully, voters in Wisconsin will look at this and say this is absolutely shocking. And we need to do whatever we can to reverse anyone who attempts to do this. I mean, that message should be sent to his approval rating should be 4 right now after doing something like that. But it won't be. Because I don't even know if people in Wisconsin care enough about the story to pay attention to it, let alone the rest of the country. This is an exaggerated example of what goes on in our government, but honestly, it's not that exaggerated in a lot of states and across the country. It's one of those situations where we get into these battles about, you know, I mean, I can't tell you how many people talk to me about Katy Perry's space flight. And while I thought that was really funny and we made fun of it quite a bit, not as important as something like this that no one seems to care about, but we care about it. So we'll try to pay attention as close as possible. There's so much to pay attention to. I can understand, honestly, how something like this slips through the cracks. We do have much more to talk about when it comes to universities, when it comes to the battle on gender, and so much more. We're going to talk about that with Inez Stettman. She comes in next. Basketball playoffs are heating up, and there's still time to turn your hot takes into cold, hard cash with Prize Picks. It's the daily fantasy app that lets you pick more or less on player projections. Right now, you might be thinking about Luka. Can you get more than 28 points? Jason Tatum, more than 8 rebounds? Which way are you going to go on those? Well, just figure that out. Get your ticket in, and that's all it takes to build a lineup. That's it. It's simple. It's fast. It's actually fun. There's no confusing odds. There's no like waiting days for results. You just pick your players and run your game. Prize Picks is the place to turn your sports knowledge into cash. With millions of members, Prize Picks has daily fantasy sports just all set up for you. It's accessible to everybody in almost every state. Run your game all season long on Prize Picks, and when you play your first $5 lineup, you'll get $50 instantly. That's right. Win or lose, you still get the bonus. $5, you get $50 instantly just for checking it out. So if you think your sports brain is playoff ready, prove it. Download the app today. Use the code STUSPORTS. You'll get $50 instantly after you play your first $5 lineup. The code is STUSPORTS on Prize Picks. Get $50 instantly when you play only $5. Prize Picks. Run your game. I'm joined now by Inez Stettman. She's senior legal analyst at the Independent Women's Forum. She has a new piece over at National Review. It's called Men Need Single-Sex Spaces Too. I'll be sure to tweet out a link to that. Inez, thanks so much for coming back on the program. Appreciate it.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, your piece is really interesting in that I think we've had this debate here over the past few years about women's only spaces and how guys who say that they're women seem to be invading them quite a bit. And I think that's set off the appropriate amount of outrage. However, we kind of don't think of this as how it affects men as well. Can you kind of walk us through your thesis here?
Yeah, sure. As you say, we've been having this huge national conversation, mostly spurred by people of one sex who claim to be the opposite sex, and of men, biological men, invading women's spaces. And of course, that's a big deal. In some ways, more sort of direct or obvious or urgent when we see girls losing, you know, sports competitions in a totally unfair way, or even see women's safety threatened in prisons because we're putting, you know, male sex offenders who claim that they're women in women's prisons. Right? These are sort of five alarm fires, but I think the ways in which not having single sex spaces have affected men and society generally has been more of a slower burn, and there hasn't been this like, oh my God, this is insane moment, but just slowly, one by one, since the 90s and early 2000s, there have been virtually no organized spaces where men can gather together and know that there won't be any women around. And I think that's been a negative, even though it's not as sort of obvious as like I said, as women getting beaten by an entire lap length in a race.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought. Well, kind of as people might look at this, they might say, well, what's the problem? What problem has been caused by this? I mean, you know, what's the problem with having men and women in the same areas? What are we losing here?
Yeah, I mean, we're losing fraternity in the classical sense, right? And not that I'm saying that this is the only reason why we've seen friendship decline and since the 90s, especially for men. You know, one in four men under 30 doesn't consider himself to have any close friends. And I think this is just a small piece of it, these spaces. But it's also sort of the sexualization of male friendship as well. And in my piece, I point to, you know, Frodo and Sam and their friendship in Lord of the Rings. Of course, in our modern culture, we consider that, like, there's all those gay jokes, right? It seems homoerotic to people because we're so unfamiliar with the idea of close bonds and close friendships in, between men. The military has been a traditional place where men can build that, but even the military now is co-ed, right? And the dynamics of a space simply change when, you know, women have their own dynamics among ourselves, right? When we're in all-girl spaces, men have their own dynamics as well. And I think those are healthy. They develop healthy masculinity. And I think we have lost a lot by making sure that even the Boy Scouts is not allowed to be just for boys to learn how to be boys and grow up into men.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think, like, as a, you know, as you're growing up, you're with your own gender. A lot of your friends are of the same gender. And you're kind of figuring out who you are, right? Like, you don't necessarily act the same way in front of your guy friends as you do your female friends. And, you know, I noticed this with my son, who's 13 now. He loves baseball. He plays sports a lot. So he's on a lot of, like, male-only teams, and he has a lot of that time. But, I mean, if you're not doing that type of thing younger, as you're a younger boy, you're probably not getting any of that anymore. The Boy Scouts, as you mentioned, are now kind of breaking those lines down. And then as you get to become an adult, I mean, you know, most kids don't you grow up to be professional athletes. There's really not much room there at all for guys to gather and just hang out. What can be done? It's just a thing of us waking up and figuring out, hey, maybe we do need these things again.
Yeah, there are really two bases on which we sort of sex integrated everything, right? The first is obviously this cultural push, and I think it's really time to reconsider that cultural push, right? To say, hey, like, now that we've recognized how important it is for girls sometimes to have, you know, female spaces, maybe we need to reconsider that cultural strong push that it's somehow unfair or backwards or discriminatory in a bad way to have, you know, and have clubs or like the Elks Club, which has declined. All those kinds of clubs have declined, not only because they've been integrated by sex, but partially because they've been integrated by sex. It's made it more difficult for them to continue to attract men to those kinds of fraternal organizations, literally fraternal organizations. So I think there's the cultural piece. There's also a legal piece here. The Civil Rights Act, especially since the 1990s and some changes that were made in the 1990s to the Civil Rights Act, has been really, really broadly and, in my view, misinterpreted by the left over the years to basically, you know, run a litany of lawsuits on any place that dared to close its doors to women. For example, there's an old bar in New York City, McSorley's Ale House, has been around since the 19th century. That was forced by the city council to admit women in the 70s. So it's been this combination of 1-2 punch of the sort of cultural quote unquote progress that I think we should reconsider, and then really broad or misinterpreted application of civil rights laws that, you know, forbid, for example, a bar from just saying, hey, like, we want it only to be men in this bar.
It's hard to imagine the left would ever misinterpret a civil rights law. I can't imagine that. And as let me go over to the universities here for a second, because you certainly have that type of thing played out maybe first in the university system. We're having this controversy now with funding of places like Harvard and Columbia. And I find it fascinating that these universities who have these brand names that are unquestionably seen as positive in most circles. Ivy League, this is like the thing you want your kid to go up and grow up and somehow get into, and it'll make their whole life go perfectly. They have these incredible reputations. And then at the same time, for some reason, our government is funding them with billions of dollars as if we need to give them a little propping up. I don't understand from the base of it. I don't understand why we do it at all. And this bizarre situation we're in now, where Harvard is seen as this brave university for turning back Donald Trump's horrible advances. I don't think the media is getting this right at all.
Yeah, not at all. fundamentally what's been going on for decades now is that the university sector feels entitled to operate substantially on federal money. That's why these threats have sent, you know, shockwaves through the university sector, is because their business model is heavily dependent on taxpayer money. There are the grants that the Trump administration is withholding from Harvard and Columbia now that amount to, in both of those schools' cases, almost $1 billion each annually. So it's a huge amount of money. But even that is the tip of the iceberg in terms of what the federal government is funding with regard to, you know, the model that higher ed, the business model that higher ed is running on. It's federally backed student loans that are the big kahuna in terms of funding. So their entire model has allowed them to stack cash and endowments, and while having their day-to-day operating expenses and most of their payroll, et cetera, heavily subsidized by the taxpayer. And they've done that all while flagrantly, we just mentioned civil rights laws, right? Flagrantly violating the basic tenets of civil rights laws by discriminating against whites and Asians in admission, by discriminating on the basis of race very openly as when they hire, right? Because their university is also a large employer. Every time they open a department and they say, like, we're going to staff this with 30% black people, that's illegal. It always has been illegal since 1964. But they're just used to doing these things and not worrying about it because these rules were never applied to them. All Donald Trump is doing is applying those rules to universities. And that's why I think, they're in full panic mode now, and they ought to be, because they really don't have an argument. They've taken taxpayer money while spitting in the eye of the average American, looking down on America and teaching their students that the United States constitutional system is racist and backwards and horrible, right? They've been doing that for decades. It's just, and they never stopped to think that actually, that was all a matter of political will. Republicans didn't have to fund, you know, their university programs, right? The taxpayer doesn't have to agree to give them billions of dollars. But I find it all very, like, encouraging and funny, even the response of universities to this. They are all suddenly realizing that they are heavily, heavily dependent on taxpayer money, and that therefore that taxpayer money has some strings attached and some laws attached to it that they've been violating for a very long time.
Yes, 100%. I mean, it really is bizarre that it took this long for conservatives to kind of grow a spine on this stuff. I mean, this was always there for the taking. Obviously, judging people by the color of their skin has never, or at least not in a long time, been popular. Since it kind of went out of favor, thankfully, a long time ago, people have always been on that bandwagon where you're just like, look, that's not how I want to judge people. They continue to do it. They continue to put it in official press releases and, you know, university policy. And the right kind of just sit back and just kind of criticized it from a distance and said, gosh, that doesn't seem right, without really ever doing anything. Why has that changed? Is it just a change of political will? Is it just, you know, Donald Trump saying, hey, this is going to be a priority of mine? What's changed?
Well, I've been arguing for Republicans to do something like this for a decade. So I'm really pleased to see Donald Trump step up and actually enforce civil rights laws against this university sector that is, again, so dependent on federal money. You know, if they don't want to take the strings that are attached to federal money, they can operate like Hillsdale College or Bob Jones University. And by the way, you know, I saw that former President Obama tweeted about this. I mean, he is the biggest hypocrite in the world when it comes to this. He tried to enforce civil rights statutes, Title IX specifically. His interpretations of those statutes, which are well beyond the text, he tried to enforce that against Hillsdale College, which doesn't take a dime of federal money, doesn't even take student loans that are backed by the federal government, and makes all of, you know, it raised all of its endowment and all of its money exclusively either from former students, from donors, or from tuition itself. So, you know, that is an option. A university can, in fact, operate without federal money and then decide what it wants to do. But yeah, I've been arguing for Republicans to do this for a very long time. I think it was always just an obvious move for people who'd be concerned about the direction, both in terms of merit and ideology at American universities. But there just wasn't the political will to do that, just like there wasn't the political will to do all kinds of effective things against the left. I mean, what we've really learned in the first few months of the Trump administration is it was always possible to apply to take the institutional left seriously and to start to dismantle what amounts to this democratic patronage network that money's, you know, flowing to NGOs, to universities. I mean, the entire professional left is basically federally funded. And Republicans just didn't have the political will or, frankly, the balls to do anything about it until Donald Trump came along.
Yeah, and that's one of the real positive changes of the last couple of years. Ines Stepmann, a senior legal analyst for the Independent Women's Forum. You can be sure to check out her piece over at National Review. It's called Men Need Single Sex Spaces 2. You can find it linked on my X page as well. Ines, thanks so much for coming on. I appreciate it. Appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Persil sorgt schon seit 1907 für tiefenreine Wäsche, auch bei den Johnsons, oder Anna?
Das stimmt. Sogar meine Oma hat schon mit Persil gewaschen.
Und als Dankeschön für über 100 Jahre Vertrauen gibt's jetzt bis zu 15 Euro Rabatt auf unser Bestes.
Das mit der roten Schleife.
Genau, made in Germany. Mehr Infos auf unserbestes.persil.de.
Wenn es tiefenrein ist, ist es Persil.
Lots of Pete Hegseth news today. Kind of started with this. Pete Hegseth said to have shared attack details in Second Signal chat. Now this, the New York Times writes, the defense secretary sent sensitive information about strikes in Yemen to an encrypted group chat that included his wife and his brother. When you kind of read the story a little bit more, it mentions that his brother is his personal lawyer, but also has a job at the Pentagon. They say it's not clear why he would need to know about upcoming military strikes. So that's what their claim is. Also, his wife, who is a former Fox News producer, not a Defense Department employee, but has traveled with him overseas, drawing criticism for accompanying her husband to sensitive meetings with foreign leaders. So that happened. Then, after all that came out, I don't know how many people got fired up about that, but then there was a report from NPR, who was exclusively reporting that the president is now looking to replace Pete Hegseth as defense secretary. Now, obviously, he wouldn't do it for that. That wouldn't make any sense at all. There would have to be something else that was going on if that was going to actually occur. The White House has already come in and said, no, we're not going to do that. This is fake news. So we'll see where this goes. Now, look, you know, back in the first administration, this type of stuff happened a lot, where something like this would be leaked, the White House would deny it, and then it would wind up happening a few days later. It happened, I remember, with H.R. McMaster. They were like, oh, no, he's not getting fired at all. And then all of a sudden he was fired and John Bolton came in. And if I remember right, that went really well, the whole John Bolton thing. I think Trump was happy with that one. Anyway, long story short, you can't trust denials. You can't trust NPR's reporting. You can't trust either, frankly. So we'll just have to see where all of this ends up. Kilmar Abrego Garcia has been transferred to El Salvador facility. He now has his own bed and furniture, ladies and gentlemen. That's right. What an incredible update. This is what I guess what was his name? I can't remember his name already. Van Hollen, something like that. That guy from Maryland, a senator that no one knew who he was until last week. He went down there, you know, shaking hands, having margaritas. He wasn't really, I don't think, having margaritas. That was seemingly like a troll from the Bukele people to make it look like he was having margaritas with oddly cherries on the rim, which I've never actually noticed that before. But that being said, they've now moved him to, I guess, a different facility, which sucks if you happen to be another MS-13 member, because you're not getting any of these perks. Only he gets these perks, apparently. There was also a situation that happened over the weekend where Donald Trump released a picture of himself holding a photo of the knuckles of Abrego Garcia, where there's four tattoos on there. And then the letters MS-13, as if that was also tattooed on his hand. That was not tattooed on his hand. It was actually just added digitally after. The theory being that these characters aligned with MS-13, like symbolized MS-13, though there's not a lot to support what it was. Again, I think, honestly, the effective thing for the Trump administration there is just to show the guy had tattoos on his knuckles, and there's just not a lot of people who do that except gang members. So I don't know. We'll see where that lands as well. Now, all of this has been going on, and this sort of embrace of potential MS-13 members has been going on. And it's an interesting tactic, right? Like most people this guy, we know at least for a fact he was accused of beating his wife. Normally, you don't run to those people and just be like, hey, you know, we're so happy to be on your side of things. Like, generally speaking, that doesn't go on. Democrats now trying to switch things up. They are facing growing calls for generational change. You know, maybe the 90-year-old people that they keep trying to put into office, and maybe not the right direction. They want some generational change. And obviously, we've now found where that generational change is going to come from. Progressive icon and ex-representative Barbara Lee has won a race for mayor of Oakland. Oakland, a wonderful, wonderful place. Barbara Lee going to be the mayor there. Surely that's going to work out, probably as well as the Los Angeles mayor thing has worked out so far, you know, for those areas of Los Angeles that still stand and are not, you know, burned to the ground. So that's going to be nice. And finally, if you're looking for generational change, let me see, I have a suggestion for you. My girl, Jasmine Crockett. Yes, Jasmine Crockett, the perhaps the greatest representative we have in Congress today. She was tearing up on MSNBC for talking about democracy or something. Here she is, though. I love this moment where she discusses the legal issues for President Trump. Watch.
But here's the reality. As far as I'm concerned, he's a lot less criminal than the person that's sitting in the White House. Because last time I checked, he doesn't have any criminal convictions. I don't even think he has any outstanding cases versus the guy that still had cases pending when he was sworn in on January 20th and also has 34 felony convictions. So listen, I don't want to hear anything from the Republican Party about how they're trying to keep us safe when their fearless leader is actually the biggest criminal thus far that we have seen, because I haven't seen anybody with a rap sheet that looks like the president's.
I've never seen anything like that. That's fascinating. She's missed so many people in history. Thus far, the greatest criminal we've ever seen is Donald Trump. I mean, I could come up with a few. I mean, anyone watched any Jeffrey Dahmer documentaries recently? Apparently that he's never seen a rap sheet like Donald Trump's, which was filling out forms incorrectly, multiplied by how many times per month he did it. There's all of his convictions for felonies. That she's never seen anything like that, even though, you know, senators on the Democratic side have been thrown out of office for much worse. So have Republicans. Obviously, criminals, any person who's been in MS-13 has crimes much, much worse than even what Donald Trump was accused of. But let's just roll with it anyway, because it flows. That's the thing with Jasmine Crockett. The words don't need to make sense. It's more of a like sing-songy flow of speech. It's not necessarily going to make sense in your prototypical English language scenarios, but you know, again, it sounds really, really good, and that's why I love her. I want her on TV all the time. More Jasmine Crockett for us to consume. As a person who has to come up with content multiple days a week, she provides it. So we love you, Jasmine. Keep talking. Is your retirement account cheering for the team kneeling during the anthem? When Wall Street shrugs at core American values, every dollar you invest could be working the other sideline. And that's a mismatch no hardworking patriot should tolerate. 90% of the big mutual funds bankroll causes that laugh at stuff like faith and freedom and, you know, basic biology. Every investment dollar is a secret ballot, and Constitution Wealth makes sure that ballot checks lower taxes, secure borders, and the freedoms your family relies on. These pros live in the market all day and still stand for the anthem at night. Yeah, that's the way you want it, right? That's all you're asking for. Basics. Legacy Media insists only the left plays shareholder politics. Reality check. Values-driven investors are already pushing boardrooms to rethink bad policies. There's been some really positive changes on this front. And this is a great part of this. It's constitutionwealth.com/please. constitutionwealth.com/please. You can get a free consultation today. constitutionwealth.com/please. Now, Constitution Wealth is a registered investment advisor. You should review Constitution Wealth's disclosures at constitutionwealth.com to understand their services and fees. All investing, of course, involves risk, including the risk of loss. I am a client of the firm. This is a paid endorsement. My opinions, however, as always, are my own. Right now, you know, Pope Francis has passed away, died on Easter Monday at the age of 88. You know, I'm not Catholic myself. Obviously, a very influential figure globally, though, is Pope Francis. And, you know, Catholics are, you know, church is going to have to figure out who comes next, of course. That's going to be a big portion of debate. It'll be interesting to see what direction they go in, because you've got kind of like the Benedict path and the Francis path, and they are very, very different. So it'll be very interesting to see which direction they go in here in the coming weeks. Another death, though, that you might not have heard as much about was Daniel Kahneman. He was an economist, a thinker. He wrote a book called Thinking Fast and Slow, which is maybe his best known work. Very, very interesting about how the human brain works. But he was a really fascinating guy. There's a book by Michael Lewis called The Undoing Project, which is really good if you haven't read it. It kind of goes through his life and a close friend of his and how they work together to kind of solve a bunch of issues. Very, very interesting book. In fact, I read both books separately, years apart, and it wasn't until I finished them both that I realized one was about the other one. So that's the sort of attention I pay, apparently, when I'm reading things. What's fascinating, though, about his death in particular, he died when he was 90 years old, is he wound up killing himself in this newfangled euthanasia sort of way. And he wasn't sick, really. He wasn't dying. He wasn't on the verge of death. He hadn't lost his faculties. He just kind of called it a day. It's fascinating. Now, there's an essay written about this in the New York Times. No surprise, partially written by Peter Singer, of all people. And if you don't know anything about him, his attitudes on life and death are quite interesting. But in explanation, Professor Kahneman wrote a letter to his friends that they would receive a few days later. Quote, "I have believed since I was a teenager that the miseries and indignities of the last years of life are superfluous, and I am acting on that belief. I am still active, enjoying many things in life, except the daily news, and will die a happy man. But my kidneys are on their last legs. The frequency of mental lapses is increasing. I'm 90 years old. It's time to go." Look, you know, we are in a society that really is changing its attitude about whether life matters. And this, of course, is often focused on the beginning of life, the very early days in the womb, and are now going to the end of life, whether it's worth living, even if you feel fine. He goes on to talk about an interview that they had before his death, where he just totally had his faculties described, you know, talked about these philosophies outwardly, called the next day and said, "Hey, thanks for the interview, had a great time." And then they never heard from him again because he just killed himself. I think we're going down the wrong road here when it comes to the sanctity of life. And that's a term that gets kind of politicized, but it shouldn't be. Like, it should be a pretty easy one. We should all think that life is important. Trying to keep it going is, you know, something that we all do. Obviously, there is some level of effort that people don't want to put in early, toward the end of life when something serious is going on with you. But to just end it because you hit a number on the calendar strikes me as a really bad precedent to be set from a guy who lived an amazing life. So, really, really sad story. No surprise Peter Singer was involved in it. Conservatives are kind of, have had a good run here lately, right? I mean, the movement is gaining ground, I think. People are waking up. The narrative of the left is cracking. The momentum is shifting a little bit. That's kind of feeling good. But the fight is not even close to being over. That's why Blaze TV exists. Because in a world full of noise, we need a stronghold for bold voices, free thinkers, and fearless commentary that help make sense of the chaos. At Blaze TV, we've built a home for some of the strongest, smartest voices in conservative media, people who tell it like it is and ask the tough questions that the mainstream won't touch and aren't afraid to challenge the narrative. It's everything the networks won't show you, delivered on your terms, on any device, at any time. And it starts at just $8 a month. The price of what? A fancy cup of coffee? When you use the promo code STU, at checkout at least, that's only 26 cents a day to stand with the platform that stands with you. So if you're ready to keep winning, shop your values and make sure we don't lose the ground we've gained. Go to blazetv.com/stu. Subscribe today. It's blazetv.com/stu. Save $20 off your annual plan now. It's blazetv.com/stu. Okay, so here's what happened. Look, if you're looking for a job, I would not suggest taking a job in the field of pornography. Not a good outcome for the rest of your life. However, maybe slightly better than that is taking a job for a band called The New Pornographers. Now, I don't know this band myself. I will say there are some tips I would say if you're going to join The New Pornographers. Number one, you got to be a great drummer, which apparently Joe Siders, I'm sure, was. However, if you happen to join The New Pornographers, you may want to stay away from actually creating child porn. of your own. I just think because the headlines are just too much. Here, this is the guy, by the way. Here's his mugshot, Joe Siders. He was actually arrested going to a bathroom. Why? Because 2 days previously, he apparently had filmed children in the bathroom, young boys in the bathroom, and then had left and apparently got away with it, but then came back to do it again. And then was finally got in trouble for it. And then you get this headline, new pornographer's drummer arrested in Southern California for possession of child sex abuse material. So suboptimal is what I would say there. I would also say suboptimal placement for the weather girl for this particular station, because it's people know who the, they don't know who the drummer is. Is she the drummer? Was she arrested? I don't know. Poor, look, I know you want to tell us the weather, but that's a tough placement.